This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 239, and I am your host, Simon Bowne. And my book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, has been published. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. It's on Amazon, and you can also get the audiobook on Spotify. This week, I'm talking to John Kendall about his book, The Metaphysics of UFOs, Evidential Case Studies on UAPs, Paranormal Phenomena, and Spiritual Experiences. Jonathan Kendall is a medical doctor, board certified in internal medicine and nephrology. He is the author of Seeing the Messiah and The Metaphysics of UFOs, books that examine extraordinary human experiences through the lens of science, history, philosophy, and metaphysics. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Simon. It's a pleasure.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called The Metaphysics of UFOs, Evidential Case Studies on UAPs, Paranormal Phenomena, and Spiritual Experiences. Before we get into that, how is it that came about that you would write this book? Have you always been interested in UFOs?
Well, Simon, it's a very interesting story. I always have been since my childhood. I remember writing a report on it in school when other people were making reports on mundane topics of history and science. I chose UFOs. Don't know what my teacher thought about that, but I chose it anyway. So I've always been fascinated with UFO stories, with ghost stories, other kind of paranormal phenomena. And I was actually researching apparitions starting about 2020, just coincidentally being about the time of the pandemic. And that led me into a kind of an ancillary issue to apparitions with the Men in Black, which is, of course, of UFO lore. So I took this huge tangent into the Men in Black, which led to UFOs, abductions, and other kinds of aspects of the phenomenon. And yeah, I got to writing about that for a couple of years before I even finished the apparitions book. So that's essentially how I came upon this. And it was every bit as fascinating as I'd ever hoped it would be.
So, yeah, you mentioned Men in Black there, and that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. Do you get the impression that they're paranormal or government agents or both?
I think it's both. Nick Redfern, Jenny Randles, they've written a couple of really good books on this phenomenon. I think there are definitely cases where paranormal aspects will occur with these MIBs, Men in Black. They'll show up to people's houses, usually as a way to intimidate them. But UFO, people that have seen UFOs, seers, basically. And sometimes what makes me lean towards there being a paranormal component to this, at least in some cases, is before the witness to this UFO has had a chance to even say anything, these people will show up at times. They'll seem to have just these impossible props, like they'll be driving antique classic cars, and yet that appear brand new. So I don't even know if government-funded agents would be able to get their hands on such things, even down to the point where the new car smell that is acquainted with new cars sometimes that aroma can be sensed around them. And then sometimes in the wake of these things, the people have poltergeist effects, things like that, that just doesn't quite ring true of human flesh and blood visitors. On the other hand, we also know that even through FOIA documents, that's Freedom of Information Act requests that have been made by some ufologists that have attested to the fact that government agents have visited UFO witnesses. So I think there's a little bit of both going on.
They do some weird stuff. It's almost as though they're trying to present themselves as humans, but they just don't quite get it right.
No, that's exactly right. There's a couple of cases where you have them going into restaurants and they order food and they get it, like say, a steak, but then they have no idea how to eat it. And someone has to actually show them with a steak knife how to eat it, how to saw it, take it apart. And then there's a couple of cases where they seem to be drinking Jell-O. You know, they get that solid square of Jell-O and they'll actually try to drink it as if they don't know, as if they don't know that they've never done it before. I know in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, the Men in Black appearances there that I write about, there's a case where someone, an MIB basically claims to be a journalist outside of Columbus, Ohio, here in the States. And he brought this little dictaphone or the recording device with him, but the witnesses claim that it's as if he didn't know how to use it. Yeah, so it's like they give themselves away in some subtle manner, either with them or the props that they bring with them, or their behavior.
Do you find they're still reported today, or they just disappeared?
I have not seen any modern reports of these. I wonder, though, if it's because you just don't have as many people writing on them like you have in the past, or at least I'm not familiar with any recent publications that talk about this. I suspect, as with abductions, I think we just don't have as many authors writing books and become bestsellers. And it's not that these things aren't occurring. It's that you just don't have as many people writing about them. That would be my sense of the matter.
And we'll be talking about alien abduction and stuff. But before we do, you have written in the book about hypnotic regression and how that can be a problem recovering memories. What have you found out there?
So I start out in chapter 4. There's a case in psychical research, goes way back. There was a man named Ansel Bourne, A-N-S-E-L, Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E. And he had all of these different paranormal experiences throughout his life. Became a preacher after he was apparently miraculously healed during a church congregation. Well, one day he woke up and he was somebody else. Took on a different name, moved to a different city, took on a very different occupation. He ran a shop, and that went on for weeks and weeks. And suddenly, this man woke up, and he remembered, I'm Ansel Bourne, and he did not remember anything that had gone on from the time that he went into what we call a dissociative fugue state. And this is actually something that's well documented in the medical literature, although it seems to be very rare. And he was hypnotically regressed to try to figure out what happened to him. And he was able to put a lot of these pieces together. He had a lot of memories that proved to be true. And there were some discrepancies when they checked out the reality of these things. But a lot of what was recovered during that hypnotic regression turned out to be actual events. So what I take from that is hypnotic regression, probably, despite some skepticism to the contrary, it is a valid way to obtain accurate memories during a period of missing time, or probably in other situations as well. Yeah, I think the caution with it, especially as we move into the alien abduction phenomenon, once that becomes part of popular culture, if a person goes into a hypnotic regression session expecting or already suspecting that he or she may have undergone an alien abduction, that expectation might contaminate what occurs during the hypnotic regression. In other words, it might be a, what comes out of that session may be a mixture of fantasy and fact. And that's where you have to be careful.
Yeah, and also the hypnotherapist has to be sure not to lead them or suggest stuff.
Absolutely.
When I do it, I work with people occasionally who are investigating alien encounters, and I'm so careful to just use the most basic stuff where I might just ask them, okay, what happened next? And I keep my questions that basic. But there were, Bud Hopkins would try and lead people to test how suggestible they were.
Right. There was a skeptical book by Kevin Randall, who's a ufologist famous for studying crash retrievals. And he had he and his co-authors, they wrote a book called The Abduction Enigma. It was a very skeptical take on it. And they had some interesting pearls there where Dave Jacobs, Bud Hopkins would send their subjects. They might have been well-meaning in it, but saying, this is what you might encounter during our hypnotic session. Be advised, be cautious. This could be disturbing, but the problem is that could lead to contamination. You're already leading the witness towards a certain conclusion. And then if you're somebody that's undergone an anomalous experience and you seek out Bud Hopkins, Dave Jacobs, you're apparently already thinking that you may have been abducted. And that sets the stage for expectations.
When I was at college and I was studying it, one of the things I remember they said was hypnosis starts the moment the person decides to do the hypnosis. And that could be weeks before the session happens. Was there a thing where, is it Alvin Lawson's imaginary abductees, and he did an experiment there with hypnosis?
Yes, very interesting study. He did a control group where he took a bunch of subjects that never claimed to see a UFO, never claimed to have been abducted, hypnotized them and said, asked them about, I think it was 8 questions, saying, tell me what would happen if you encountered a UFO. Tell me about if you were led inside the UFO, what you're seeing. And he found a lot of common things were being reported amongst these, quote, imaginary abductees versus those that the narratives produced by those that had claimed to be abducted. And his argument was that this was a purely psychological phenomena. That study has been subjected to criticism. For instance, his imaginary abductees would see a wide variety of different entities. The abductors they might appear human, they might appear as the Greys, they might appear ghostly or grotesque. I think there are about 6 different categories. Whereas it was more commonly humanoid amongst the group that was actually claiming to have experienced a real abduction. And there were some other important differences as well. So the traumatic effects didn't affect the control group, but the post-traumatic effects did affect the people that actually claimed abduction and so forth. So yeah, I don't think he was able to reduce the whole abduction experience to a psychological phenomenon, but it was an interesting study.
And suggesting perhaps people only remember abduction events under hypnosis is just not true, isn't it?
No, that's absolutely true. In fact, the majority of patients or subjects or abductees remember at least partially their experience, if not the whole thing. Hypnosis is usually used as a supplement. And then some people claim that eventually they come to remember everything about their experience, just without the aid of hypnosis. So yeah, that's actually a very good point.
But the problem is how much of what they are remembering is real. Because of what I was taught is it may be 30% of what is remembered is not real. But it's also just like how our memory is when we're not hypnotized, because it's not great anyway, is it?
Correct. Memory is reconstructive. We don't have our memories as such where it plays like a recording in our minds. It's constructive. We tend to conflate one aspect of our lives with another and so forth. I will say, though, very salient, life-changing events like these tend to be remembered fairly vividly. That doesn't mean that the recall is going to be 100%, but these tend to be remembered very vividly. It's kind of like you remember the circumstances of when you were married, if you were ever married, or when your country wins the World Cup, or for me, whenever the Kentucky Wildcats won the NCAA championship. I remember those events, where I was, who I was with, very vividly. And I think that would apply in this case as well, although you do have the complicating matter of the missing time that commonly is associated with abductions. But again, memory is frequently recalled, at least in fragments, from that, and that's something to work with. I think another thing worth pointing out as well, in my research and in this book, Metaphysics of UFOs, I take a somewhat skeptical view, not totally, But I admit that we have to be cautious with the narrative that is uncovered through hypnotic regression. However, that's not the whole story, because experiencers usually will remember some of their abduction memories through continuous recall, but also they'll usually remember seeing the UFO and then the after effects, Men in Black visitations, poltergeist phenomenon, enhanced psychic abilities, things like that require an explanation. So even if we just totally take a skeptical view of what's recovered during the abduction, say the Betty and Barney Hill case, what put abductions on the map that occurred in 1961 in New Hampshire. Even if we take a skeptical view of everything that Benjamin Simon uncovered under hypnotic regression, you still have a very close encounter of Betty and Barney Hill. They both remember seeing the UFO. Barney remembers seeing occupants inside it. They both had all these really strange things that happened in the aftermath of that experience, like MIBs, poltergeists. Other members of the family would see things. One of my favorite stories was there was a cat that was outside and wanted to come in into the house from the porch, and the sliding door just opened on its own. The cat walked in and the sliding door closed. A number of people saw this phenomenon. And then you have to account for the missing time. They got home 2 hours late. So we may be skeptical of what Benjamin Simon uncovered. And in fact, he took a skeptical view. He thought that what they were, rightly or wrongly, he thought that what Betty and Barney Hill produced under hypnotic regression was fantasy. But they arrived home 2 hours late, so that missing time has to be accounted for with something. And I don't think sleep paralysis or dissociative fugue states, that doesn't happen to two people at the same time. So there's a lot there that has to be accounted for besides the actual part remembered under hypnotic regression.
And also, was it the little bits of the car were highly polished and that compasses would behave really strange around those parts of the car?
Yes, and that was one of the more fascinating aspects of this phenomenon. You'd hold a compass over it, and I remember the dial would just spin around and around. Eventually, that effect went away, but it really suggested that there were some magnetic anomalies that occurred on that car. That lasted, I believe, for maybe a week afterwards. Kathleen Martin, who was Betty Hill's niece, wrote a good book somewhat recently, within the last 20 years, on her aunt's abduction experience. And she was actually witness to a lot of this phenomenon, including the strange compass behavior.
Yes, she was on my podcast a couple of times.
Cool.
She told me that there was a time when Betty was very old. She was living at Kathleen's house and they were caring for her. And they had a baby monitor overnight. And Kathleen heard Betty say, "Oh, I never thought I'd see you again." And Kathleen said, "I was too scared to get up and go and investigate. I just wonder what or who that was in Betty's bedroom."
Wow, that's an awesome story. I would expect she had a reunion apparition. Betty probably saw a deceased loved one. And that's actually quite common.
Yeah, it's deathbed visions, isn't it? That kind of thing.
Yes. And this abduction experience, you see those stories in these cases, case after case, these after effects, these paranormal after effects seem to follow these experiencers. Sometimes people that have just seen a UFO and don't necessarily claim an abduction experience, but also the abductees, they'll claim to have been healed during the experience. Sometimes it's like they've gotten a psychic charge. They might have felt that they were psychic to begin with, and afterwards it's like they got supercharged. Their experience with the liminal just becomes all the more real to them. They'll have precognitive glimpses. That's glimpses into the future. Sometimes it will occur spontaneously. They'll have other kinds of experiences, like seeing apparitions. That's actually quite common. Yeah, and it's positive or negative, something impacts these people. And I think it adds to the objective nature of what they experienced.
And also, those after effects are reported by people who have near-death experiences. That makes you wonder, what is the connection there?
Yeah, I wrote an article to that effect, which is a companion article to the book. It's on Llewellyn.com, where I talk about the similarities of near-death experiences and alien abductions, two things that you would think would not have anything in common at all, but they have all these after effects. And really, the strange thing is, at some point, they are very positive after effects, not only with near-death experiences, but most abductees claim that eventually, after they get over the initial trauma, they're actually happy to have had their experience. Not only do they have these psychic after effects, but they have positive life changes. It's almost as if they're getting, dare I say, born again like experiences. They're more compassionate. They're likely to give up self-destructive behaviors. They might even change their occupation to one that helps people. They are more spiritual. They have less of fear of death. And that might be the single biggest surprise. And there are many such surprises, but that might be the single biggest surprise of this whole research for me.
It points to something to do with consciousness, doesn't it? And it's like some abductees talk about how it wasn't their physical body that was taken. It was their consciousness. It was like an out-of-body experience. And a near-death experience is an out-of-body experience. So there's almost like there's something they bring back when they re-enter the body.
Oh, 100%. There's something having to do with consciousness that defines this phenomenon. And people, abductees, it's interesting. There seems to be a dichotomy because a lot of abductees will seemingly be taken and wake up somewhere else. It could even be miles away, which suggests that something may have actually happened to their physical body. But then a number of them, probably the majority, according to Ray Hernandez's recent free study, suggests that it is more of an out-of-body experience. I think they're tapping into what we may call, for lack of a better description, some spiritual realm. And it makes them much more sensitive to liminal phenomena. And I think that explains the after effects, that they have the psychic aspects, at least. It's very similar to other kinds of experiences, like mystical experiences, shamanic trans journeys. I would even add another category, like psychedelic experiences as well.
What do you think of this theory, this idea? I think it was Jacques Vallée who might have said it first. This idea that this is a phenomenon that's been around for hundreds or thousands of years, and that we interpret it according to what we know in that time period. So we might see them as elves or fairies, but now in a technological society, we're seeing them as aliens or spaceships.
I think they're on the right track. I would say I'm... And this is where we'll get in some trouble, Simon, with those that are passionate about the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But I think Vallée, he called it a control system, like a spiritual control system. Keel called them ultra-terrestrials. Whatever the case, I think that this is an interdimensional phenomenon. They're coming from some reality parallel to ours. And that is, in essence, the view I lean towards, as far as being the correct view.
And also, I wonder when people like years ago would see elves and now they see aliens, is that the phenomenon deciding to display itself like that? Or is there something about our consciousness that's imprinting upon them that gives them that image?
Now, that's a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think that we are imprinting on this phenomenon itself. Some would argue that all a paranormal phenomena, everything we've talked about, including religious visions, are all manifestations of our individual, but also the collective consciousness that we are, in essence, if when it comes to religion, worshiping our own sense of unity with one another, and that we're subconsciously producing these manifestations. I think that definitely plays a role. I've studied that to some degree. But I think that there's also non-human intelligences out there as well. And I think sometimes it's difficult to tease out when we read a good case. Well, is this all our own human agency with the help of the subliminal mind or the higher self? Or are we interacting with something other, some other kind of intelligence, some other agency? Yeah, it's difficult to tease out. My best guess would be that we co-create this phenomena. We're tapping in. Maybe the NHI creates some kind of, if you will, paranormal Wi-Fi. And then sometimes the reception is better with certain people and in certain areas, like flap areas, than others. I think that is definitely plays into it.
But I suppose also there could be several different races visiting the planet, and they're at different levels. Some are interdimensional, some of them are physical, because we get reports of both of those things.
It very well could be. I think for the purposes of parsimony, I think that whatever we make of the UFO phenomenon, it is a very physical phenomenon. We've been talking mostly about the spiritual thus far, or the paranormal aspects of it, but you've also got situations where these craft will land. They'll leave depressions in the earth even after they're long gone. They'll leave traces. The elements or the chemical makeup of what's inside these depression areas is different from what's growing outside of it. They'll affect vegetation. They'll affect human beings. Jacques Vallée lists in one of his Forbidden Science journals, he says that there's over 900 cases of reports of people being harmed when in the vicinity of UFOs. I think that's mostly incidental or inadvertent. I don't think it's necessarily in all cases hostile action on the part of the UFOs, but it does leave an indelible mark on the environment and on people that witness these things as well. And then when people are in their cars, there's all these reports where the car will go dead. So that aspect of the phenomenon has to be taken seriously, as well as the paranormal aspect. People have more of a nuts and bolts view that the extraterrestrial hypothesis, typically, they'll want to throw out the high strangeness, the paranormal fallout, whereas people that think of it as more of a spiritual phenomenon want to play down the physical aspects of it. I think the reality is both of these are very well attested by the data, these aspects. And whatever we conclude about them, we have to take into account both aspects.
And another thing about the aliens, and I talk about this quite often on the podcast, is the thing is that they're humanoid. They're just like us, with a head and two arms and two legs. And then they're able to tolerate Earth's atmosphere, the pressure, like the oxygen mix, the gas mix, whether there's any diseases or viruses, and they seem to be fine with Earth's gravity. That doesn't make sense, does it? If they were supposed to have evolved on another planet?
I think you're right. I think that definitely provides evidence of more of a interdimensional phenomenon, that these hail from some other plane of existence, and they're able to shapeshift almost, because the grays, the insectolins, the reptilians that people see, they are different from us, but there's also a lot in common. They share the symmetry that we do. They have two eyes. I think generally all those different species are reported to have two eyes facing the front on that part of the head, two arms, two legs, and like you say, humanoid in experience. And then the Nordics are basically just very beautiful, very handsome versions of human beings. They seem to be almost totally human looking. I think if extraterrestrial life exists, I think it's quite plausible that it does. Jack Cohen and Ian Stewart, they wrote a great book called Evolving the Alien, where they say that extraterrestrial life will evolve based on whatever resources are available to it. So, for instance, if there's another planet that has a lot of ultraviolet light, way more than what we could tolerate, then life, if it's conducive to evolving there into complex forms, will take that into account. And they say when you take all these factors together, that whatever the extraterrestrial life is going to be, it's going to look much different from anything we could imagine. It's probably, it might even be incomprehensible to us. So I think that is further, that further makes me lean, that's an argument against the extraterrestrial hypothesis and more for a kind of a shape-shifting interdimensional entity.
Or perhaps what we see here is something that's been genetically engineered to operate on Earth, and that's not, you know, the small greys are, some people do describe them as robotic or worker bees, but then the tall ones seem to be coming here as well. I'm just confusing myself as I'm speaking.
Sure. Yeah, I think you could be dealing with AI. I've heard that theory as well, or that these are essentially robots, more or less. And that would also explain why they're able to apparently breathe our air and so forth. Yeah, I think when you talk about the genetics of it, if these are extraterrestrials, and it kind of gets back to what we were talking about in the last segment, these are extraterrestrials, they would have had to evolve independently of us. Their systems would have to be DNA-based. Their base pairs would have to presumably be the code for the same, what we call codons. Three base pairs have codons that code for amino acids, and they would have to use the same 20 amino acids as us. Their genes would have to be very similar. The resulting cells, the organelles, would have to be very similar because we have cell membranes that function very, very specific ways. Ribosomes, nuclei, mitochondria. And as you keep going on down the lines, all the way when you get to embryogenesis, the chances that another species could have evolved all of this machinery independently of the life that has, a complex life that has evolved here upon the Earth to the point where we could actually form hybrids with them, for instance, or we could be genetically compatible, the chances of that approaches zero very quickly.
And it's confusing because so many people report meeting these hybrids. Is it that transgenesis is a better way to describe them?
So, yeah, I know your guest from a recently downloaded podcast with Dr. Luck, I believe, Dr. Andreas.
Yeah.
Yeah, he seemed to kind of go down the same path that I just did, talking about how unlikely it would have been. But then he talks about transgenics, and I just wonder about that. Could it would be just a completely different genetic makeup. I mean, there you'd have to almost have to build from the ground up. Right. I mean, everything, their genome, the genome that's engineered to make it compatible with human DNA, I think would be very different from the parent species. And I just wonder, I suppose a very highly advanced society could do that. Maybe you wonder kind of why they would want to, or why would they would need to, if they had that level of transgenic ability.
It's yeah, but then people report seeing these children that look half grey, and then over time they see others that are very nearly human but not quite, and that's like a contradiction, isn't it? It's also an idea, I suppose. We just don't know how advanced their technology might be. They might be able to do this.
I've read a number of cases where people encounter these hybrids or hybrids within the context of abductions. Are you talking about even just walking around in the streets?
No, I'm just talking during abductions when, you know, there's some people, they bring them over and they say, this is your child or something.
Right. It could be that that's symbolic, potentially. That's kind of the tack that John Mack took. A lot of his abductees would claim the same kinds of things, that there was some kind of sexual aspect to it or hybridization aspect to it. He thought it was more symbolic of something that was occurring on a higher level of existence or a different vibratory level or a metaphysical level. That's a possibility. And then there's always the possibility of that being part of what we talked about at the beginning, confabulation during hypnosis. I know Jacobs developed a very rich ecology. I think he had, what, 5 or 6 different levels of the hybrids or hybrid species in one of his books. But a lot of his, maybe not all, but a lot of these recollections were made through hypnosis, if I'm not mistaken. And could it be that that was part of the confabulation, that was part of the fantasy?
And we also have reports, people say they're taken on board, women have eggs taken, men have sperm taken, and then there's the reports from women of pregnancies that go missing. And I've talked to a number of women who've reported that, and one of them said they woke up in the morning, the baby was gone, there was no sign of a miscarriage, no blood or anything in the bed, and she saw the doctor. The doctor said, we're going to have to do a D&C. Is that right? Is it a D&C?
Yes, dilation and curettage.
And the doctor went to do it and then came back and said, we don't need to do it. It's already been done. But he was the doctor that confirmed she was pregnant. So he, for him, it's confusing. But she said to me, I can't tell him it was the aliens, can I?
Right. Yeah, no, that certainly is a strange story. And I'm not going to speak for anybody's experience, any woman that has gone through this. I know Bud Hopkins and then especially Jacobs talked to a number that had that experience. I know missed abortions, especially if it occurs in the first trimester, sometimes that can be, the female body can resorb that in such a way where it's not noticeable, where it the remains are not expunged in the way that you might expect. I actually cite an article where that occurs. I don't know if that explains it all or not, Simon. I'm certainly open to these other possibilities, and I certainly wouldn't speak for another woman's or lady's experience with this thing. I know some of these reports that I've read, they claimed they weren't even sexually active at the time. They found themselves pregnant, then they go in for an ultrasound, and then they're not. And then they happen to remember that they had one of these abduction experiences before that. It certainly is interesting. I take a provisionally skeptical view of that, but far be it for me to speak for any lady's experience. I don't want to go down that path.
Now, we do see these guys like in the 90s, like Bud Hopkins and John Mack and David Jacobs working with people who have these experiences, but they seem to come to different conclusions of what's going on. Do you think that's down to the individuals doing the hypnotic sessions? And it's perhaps like John Mack will ask something and something will come up, maybe spiritual, and he'll be, oh, that's interesting. But David Jacobs gets that answer and he's like, oh, no, forget that. Let's move on from there. And so they go down different paths and have different conclusions.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. Investigator influences definitely seem to play a role in that. Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs took a extraterrestrial hypothesis view of the abduction phenomenon, and both eventually thought that this was essentially a hybridization program, and this was scary. It was malevolent, and it's not surprising that most of their abductees agreed with them. This was malevolent, what is occurring. Mack, on the other hand, who had interest in Eastern mysticism, you read his 1994 book and then the book he published later, Passport to the Cosmos. He talks about all these people having these spiritual experiences like dual alien human identities. He would talk about reincarnation, and then some of his subjects would believe that they were reincarnated. And they would have all these very robust spiritual views of it. And you wonder, is this real or does this somehow reflect the investigator? I don't think it's coincidental that of those three major investigators, Mack is the one that had more of the spiritual views, and a lot of his subjects came to view it more positively, more spiritually in nature, and came to believe similar things that he does. Jacobs, on the other hand, I kind of wonder if he turned more positive experiences, spiritual experiences, into negative. He talks about one case where a lady thought that she had this protective guardian that would come and stay with her, I believe, at night, if memory serves. And he hypnotically regressed her, and he claimed, well, she takes a much less romantic view of that now because it turned into an alien abduction. There was also a case from Jacobs where he had hypnotized somebody who recalls having seen in the Virgin Islands, having had what I call a reunion apparition. She woke up to see at the foot of the bed someone in her family. I can't remember if it was a spouse or a mother or father or a child, but just appeared transfigured. It's a sign saying, hey, I'm okay. I'm in the afterlife now. You don't need to worry about me. And whenever he hypnotized her and they talked about that experience, voila, that reunion apparition, that ghost, instead of it being a positive experience, it was a gray alien standing there. And so I think he turned a couple inadvertently. I don't think he had any malice or ill intent by any stretch of the imagination. But that shows you that investigator influences, I think, can have a role in this and what people perceive.
So there's something in the book you talk about of this idea that the Greys picking up abductees and subject them to painful physical exams seems a bit primitive for aliens who have such amazing technology.
Yes, I think even if we were to be, say, transported to some inhabited planet now, even with human technology, I think we obviously can't get there because we don't have the power to go astronomical distances. But I think even we wouldn't be that primitive. I think we could send out some kind of drone, maybe the size of a mosquito, that could take a skin sample off anyone we chose, or maybe got a blood sample, be like a mosquito bite, returns to us. I think the military probably has applications like this right now. We could find out all we want to about a person. Thinking about this a little bit more, I do wonder, you could argue this mind scan that Jacobs talks about. Maybe for that, maybe for finding out how a human brain works, say something that they have some kind of scanning ability, whether it's telepathic or some kind of device that would be akin to our PET scans or our functional MRIs. Maybe it requires close proximity to abductees to run that. Maybe that's why they abduct people. Maybe such a thing can't be done from a distance. But I think overall, the process seems very primitive to me for it to really be extraterrestrial in nature. What I think it is, I think whatever the phenomenon is, it wants us to believe that it's extraterrestrial and that it's doing these things, maybe even having a hybridization program. And I think it's all theater for whatever reason.
Yeah, because in the book it says these crude medical procedures could be staged as some rite of passage.
That's a possibility as well. And that brings us back to the psychic after effects. Is this some way to get us to tap in? And you look back in the past, Simon, interestingly enough, who experiences the paranormal? Who experiences the spiritual world where they'll see apparitions of deceased loved ones, or they're more likely to experience near-death experiences? Someone that's had some kind of a trauma in the past, whether it's a physical trauma or other kinds like sexual abuse, those kinds of things. So maybe this is some way that they're leading us into higher forms of evolution, and maybe the psychical after effects, not to mention the moral, positive moral after effects that seem to affect so many of these people. Maybe that's the point of all this. And maybe it is somehow a benevolent phenomenon after all.
I wanted to talk to you about, is it Bertrand Mayhurst?
Yes.
French guy who did loads of research, but that was decades ago, wasn't it? Did he come up with stories people were reporting way before Second World War that sound like abduction tales?
Yes. From about 1880 up to about World War II, so sometime in the 1940s, there were all these pulp magazines that came out, pulp periodicals, where there were science fiction, and a lot of the things that you saw, like Ego Tims, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, one of those fictional stories mimicked what would later become your basic abduction narrative to a large degree. Even Thomas Bullard, Eddie Bullard, who's probably the leading authority on abduction research, he claims that most, if not all, of the abduction phenomenon was prefigured in antecedent science fiction. Now, I'm still a little skeptical of that view. That was an attempt to try to reduce it all to a more psychological phenomenon. I'm still skeptical of that, though, Simon, because these are very obscure references, these pulps. I don't think Betty and Barney Hill were reading the pulp magazines. Yeah. These things appeared in. Some of them weren't even in the language of the experiencers that were having them. And another thing I think it's important to point to while we're on that, I find it interesting that so many people, at least up through the 1980s, and Bullard really demonstrated this with great alacrity, they would have the same experience almost. It would be just the same narrative. They'd be taken usually to a spacecraft or maybe some kind of subterranean realm. There would be a light source, or there would be light, but it's unclear where the light source would come. They'd be laid on a table that didn't have legs. It would either float or it'd be part of the ship, the abductee would. There would be an eye-like device come out of the ceiling and look at them. You'd have the mind scan, the apparent manipulation of producing fear, or with a mere hand wave, producing relief or even bliss or even sexual desire on the part of the abductee, or great sexual arousal. I think Steve Aspen, he lists in his book Out of Time dozens and dozens of these things. And it's, you could make an argument, and it's even down to the same order. The same order occurs, according to Bullard, at least in the broad contours, all the way up until at least the mid to late 1980s, is if these are subjective phenomena, how is it possible that the order of events and the events themselves are so similar, so eerily similar to one another? I think it's important to point out that based on more recent research, the order of it all seems to start to break down a little bit, but it's still intriguing nonetheless that all the way up into the mid-80s or so, that the experience was so similar across hundreds of different cases.
Yeah, it sort of suggests some kind of authenticity, because back then, how would they fake it if there were people all over the world sending mail to each other, and it was letters in those days, and say, well, if you talk to an investigator, make sure you tell them this.
No, that's exactly right. And in the book, I talk about, I play devil's advocate. I say, this is how it might have happened. You've got Betty and Barney Hill, who were abducted in 1961. Later on, Fuller writes the book, The Interrupted Journey, in 1966. It's a bestseller. Then you've got Shermer, who's an Arkansas police officer who's abducted in 67. 1973, you got the Pascagoula, Mississippi case. You could argue that maybe they were aware of the phenomenon at that time. 1975, you've got the UFO incident that comes out, which was based on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. You've got, later on, you've got Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time, in the 1980s, and so forth. I play devil's advocate and try to piece together how all this might have played out. But again, it's at the end of the day, I just can't accept that all these abductees happen to be watching all of these different programs. Yes, they were fairly well known. It was becoming more and more of a cultural phenomenon, but I don't think, in my gut at least, that explains it all. I think the skeptics have a somewhat decent case, but for me, it's not a definitive one.
And there's a criticism, I think, in society that people report seeing greys because that's a well-known image now, and so that's what people will see, or they think they see. But that makes me think, well, also Chewbacca's a well-known image. Why don't somebody say they saw Chewbacca?
Yeah. Hey, that's a fair point. Bud Hopkins, he points out counter. He said, yeah, this might be some of this might be prefigured in the pulp magazines and that probably nobody has read, probably not one abductee has read, and some of the science fiction movies that came out in America in the 1950s, early 1960s. Yep. However, you're right. Star Wars, that was hugely popular. You got Independence Day that came out in 1996, and you've got ray guns and all these kinds of things that are not really, you don't see that in the abduction literature. So there's a lot of science fiction that was not picked up. And I think that serves as a very nice counterpoint.
So I wanted to talk to you about sleep paralysis, because there are some skeptics who say, oh, that explains it all. But it doesn't, does it?
No, I don't think so at all. Sleep paralysis is a situation where the experiencer, usually you wake up, your back is against the bed, doesn't have to be, and you're literally in a half awake, half dreaming state. You can't move, and you see strange imagery superimposed upon the room you're asleep in, usually the bedroom. And that's because you've got these neurotransmitters in your brain that while we sleep, it causes us to lose muscle tone. That's why you can be very active running or swimming in your dream, and you don't act it out. For the most part, you're staying still because of these neurotransmitters. And when you awake, those neurotransmitters are downgraded, and you get other neurotransmitters in your brain that makes you be able to use your skeletal muscles again. Well, when you wake up in sleep paralysis, the brain still thinks you're in partial REM sleep. So those inhibitory neurotransmitters are still active, and that's why you can't breathe deeply. You can't use your intercostal muscles as well around your ribs. You can't move because your skeletal muscles are still have decreased tone because of the chemical situation that's going on in your body. And you're also seeing dream imagery. And it's a very visceral fear that these people experience. Up to 25% may experience at least one episode in their lives, maybe even more than 25%. And that's your classic. A lot of people will see shadowy figures approaching their bed. Sometimes they'll actually get on their chest, and it's as if that's what's causing them not to be able to breathe. It's the classic demon sitting on your chest. And that's commonly hallucinatory. I do wonder in some cases if that might be a liminal phenomenon where you could actually have contact with non-human intelligences. We'll put that to the side here for the purpose of this discussion. Okay, so you have an experience like that. Alien abductions have become well known as part of culture. What you see during this episode of sleep paralysis is, let's say, a gray alien. Well, you go back to sleep, you wake up, and you seek out an abduction researcher, and they hypnotize you. You go in with a certain level of expectations, and voila, you've got a alien abduction narrative brought about through hypnotic recall. That would explain, I think, a good number of cases now. I don't think it would explain the original phenomenon as well, because back in the 60s, it wasn't really part of our popular culture. Not a whole lot of people knew about alien abductions. But more importantly, people would experience these things as part of the awake state. And often they would be driving cars like Betty and Barney Hill, or like the Casey County, Kentucky abduction case. Importantly, Simon, 10 to 20% of the caseload of abductions occur to multiple people at once. And two people cannot have the same hallucination at one time, at least not a subjective hallucination. And that's why sleep paralysis really cannot explain all episodes, and especially some of the older ones.
And this sleep paralysis has been known for a long time, hasn't it? Because there's different countries have different kind of folklore around it.
Yeah, 100%. The authority on that would be David Hufford, a book called The Terror That Comes in the Night. And that was written decades ago.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called The Metaphysics of UFOs, Evidential Case Studies on UAPs, Paranormal Phenomena, and Spiritual Experiences. And can you tell everybody where they can get that?
Yes, you can get it from my publisher at Llewellyn Worldwide, llewellyn.com. and it's available on third-party sellers like Amazon.com. Those would probably be your best bets.
And do you have a website?
Yes, Jonathan Kendall, JonathanKendallMD.com. You'll be disappointed, by the way, if you think you're going to get medical advice on that. This is all regarding my interest in the paranormal world, this website. And then you can follow me on X as well, if you're so inclined, at J Kendall, J, just the letter, KENDALLMD.
Fantastic. And thanks again for coming on.
Simon, thank you very much for having me. It's been an honor.
And that was an interview with John Kendall about his book, The Metaphysics of UFOs, Evidential Case Studies on UAPs, Paranormal Phenomena, and Spiritual Experiences. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFO podcast. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.